Welcome to The Way Forward, Regenerative Conversation Podcast number 3. I'm Jim Burke, the producer. While top-down hierarchical organizations have historically been good at addressing complicated issues, we are now faced with complex problems that need a new way of organizing that engages collectively many people who can feel ownership of the issues. For David Ehrlichman, one of the biggest challenges our civilization faces in The Way Forward is how we as humans organize and concentrate power. Our hosts, Alain Gauthier and Dr. John Izzo, talk with David about his journey co-founding Converge, Hatch Protocol, and writing the book, Impact Networks, Create Connection, Spark Collaboration, and Catalyze Systemic Change. We learned that in his early work with nonprofits, David felt he was just addressing the symptoms of a massively broken system. He began asking himself how he could work across organizations and even across sectors. This led to his work integrating network science and systems thinking into cross-sector, multi-stakeholder collaborations. David talks about a quality of leadership that is facilitative and non-directive, where it supports people coming together and discovering what they can do collectively. David sees this as a deliberate process which allows for emergent results. It's planful, but it plans for emergence. He shares with us that his personal mission in life for many years has been to catalyze others to make their greatest contribution. He feels hopeful because he sees a paradigm shift happening with increasing focus on networks as a different type of organizing structures. And now for our hosts, Dr. John Izzo and Alain Gauthier.
Hi, I'm Dr. John Izzo, and on behalf of my co-host, Alain Gauthier, I want to welcome you to the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast, in which we explore the future of humanity and planet and all the ways we need to move forward to a more positive future. So Alain, great to be here and so excited for the guests that we have with us today, because I know in my work in business and in the NGO world, I'm so aware that there's so many good things happening, so many efforts that businesses and NGOs and even just groups of people who are coming together organically are doing to try to seize the opportunities of our age and solve the problems of our time. And yet I see so often those efforts are sub-optimized because of ego or simply people working alone and not having the capacity to address challenges to the level they need to. And so I'm so excited today to explore this idea of how really networks of organizations can come together to make a difference. Alain, anything you want to say before we welcome David in?
Yes, I have the same observation that, and sometimes the most surprising thing for me, especially working with nonprofit, is that the fact that nonprofit look for specific funding makes them sometimes more isolated from others than cooperating with others. It's going to be very interesting to hear David's perspective on that. So why don't you start with the first question, John?
Yeah, and selflessly, David, I'll be using your advice today because, among other things, I co-founded an NGO at the University of British Columbia called Blueprint, dedicated to really reimagining a new kind of masculinity for society and for men. And we're having that same challenge around how do we really network with others. So David Ehrlichman, welcome and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here with you all.
So David, we're going to have a chance to get into who you are and what you do. But before we do, we always like to ask our guests a really big question to start, which is, in your view, does humanity need a new way forward? And what do you think is not working now or must change for us to, you know, if you had to choose just one or two things that you think must change in terms of what's not working now for us to, in fact, have a positive way forward? So first, do you think we need a new way forward? And if so, for you, what's the crux of what we need to do to get there?
Well, I do think we need a new way forward. And what got us where we are today isn't going to get us to where we need to go. And I think the biggest change for me is in how we organize. Do we concentrate power and decision-making to the few at the top of whatever pyramid or hierarchical structure we've created? Or do we share leadership? Do we engage with one another collaboratively? Do we find ways to engage large numbers of people as equals? And do we push decision-making and actions to, you know, to the ground, to the grassroots, to the people who are closest to the issues and most affected by the issues? Now, I see the opportunity in this shift of organizing from centralized ways of working to more decentralized ways of working, from individual leaders to leaderful communities and collaboratives. It's not that hierarchy is inherently bad, because it's not. Hierarchy is just a way of organizing, which is really good at addressing certain types of complicated problems, which we can get into. But it's really the ethos of collective action, of decentralization, of individual sovereignty and autonomy, and of people having ownership and decision-making in the things that they contribute to. That's the way of organizing that I want to see evolve and open up, so that we can engage large numbers of people who I think want to contribute, but sometimes just don't know quite how to plug in.
Wonderful. So, David, we'd like to ask you, what has led you to actually focus your work, Impact Networks?
Well, I was working in a nonprofit organization a long time ago, maybe 15 years ago, and really early in my career. They were doing incredible work, really serving individual people in profound ways. But I also noticed a couple of things when I was there. That number one, felt like they were addressing the symptoms of this massive broken system. And in the case of this nonprofit, it was supporting people without shelter to get trained in and find jobs in the culinary industry. But it's working in this massive system in the King County, Seattle region where I live, where there's just chronic lack of housing and lack of shelter. And there are so many issues that lead to individuals not having the shelter or the opportunities. And I also saw how this organization, like so many others, as you referenced earlier, that they are pushed by the system to be very focused on continuing to raise funding, to continue to to keep their operations running. A lot of time that comes in with foundation funding cycles that are just year over year and tied to very specific outcomes, not general operating funds. And it really forces organizations to focus on a narrow piece of it, but also to have to show the causation between those funding dollars and the work that they do. But the issue here is that these problems, they're so complex, they're so interwoven with so many different pieces, and we can't just work as individuals or as individual organizations to meaningfully address the problems at the root and to create shifts that affect the whole system and not just individual actors. Both are important, but I think sometimes we miss that the whole systems change because we are so focused as individuals and individual organizations and our own survival and the survival of our organizations. But the challenge is when we begin to work across organizations, it's much harder to draw that direct causation. Yeah. And sometimes it's harder to advocate for the specific funding dollars to keep your organization's lights on. So there are conflicts of interest there. And the way the funding process is set up, it really, in a lot of ways, disincentivizes collaboration, even when funders try to say that they want to see more and more collaboration. The system just isn't set up for that. And so that was the first question for me, is how can we work not just within individual organizations, but really across organizations and even across sectors, and sometimes even across geographies, to address these big wicked challenges? And that question stuck with me. It led me to Monitor Institute. I was there, and Monitor Institute was the social sector wing of a consulting firm. And they, at that time, were really kind of thinking a lot about and writing a lot about cross-sector collaboration and how we learning from past efforts and social movements, community building, but also then integrating network science and systems thinking to pursue multi-stakeholder collaboration in a way that could lead to positive outcomes for all, that is not a zero-sum game. And from there, I left Monitor and had the opportunity to be a founding coordinator for a network in Fresno, California that connected first 12, then 24, then 36 different organizational leaders from all sectors to revitalize their city. And that included people from the superintendent and the public schools advocate to the charter school advocate and the environmental activists to the enlightened developers and private sector organizations and nonprofits and academic institutions, the whole gamut of different sectors, and saw there for the first time at that depth in my life the power of relationship to shift the way that people communicate with one another and share information and identify and pursue opportunities to coordinate their work, that there was so much they disagreed about and often came into the room at the first place focusing on those differences of opinion or beliefs. But as you dug deep enough, eventually you could find some common values that we shared. And even if we have different opinions on exactly what to do, a lot of times the underlying whys are very similar. And if you can start there and begin to build a foundation of trust, not trust for liking, don't need to like each other, not trust for agreement, but trust for action, trust so that we can get things done, trust to facilitate the flow of information and resources, that it opens the door and unlocks opportunities for much larger scale coordination. And that then my next step was a founding coordinator for a network in the Santa Cruz Mountains region, which brought together over 20 different organizations to steward 500,000 acres of land. And again, this is a systemic challenge, because if you focus on stewarding an individual parcel of land and getting rid of all the invasive species on your piece of land, but your neighbor hasn't done the same, it doesn't much matter. So we have to look at the level of the whole ecosystem. And that, that involved bringing together major landowners and land managers in the region, from academic institutions and land trusts, but also timber companies and tribal groups and environmental organizations. And again, lots they disagreed about, but also all shared a special connection with the place and the land. And there was a lot that they could agree on and recognize that good stewardship at a landscape level requires not a single approach, but really a mosaic approach that can address these issues from many different angles at once, but as part of this smart coordinated effort. We don't all need to do one thing together, but we can improve the health and the effectiveness of our systems as a whole by increasing the connections and the flows of information, the opportunities to coordinate with one another. So long story short, that led me to co-found Converge in 2013 with a colleague of mine and David Sawyer. And over the past almost 10 years now, I've had the opportunity to work with over 50 or 60 different impact networks, very different focus areas. Each network is really different in terms of the people and the history and the context, but also we've seen common patterns among them. There's a lot that's similar in terms of how they start and how they form and the processes or tools, frameworks that they can use to think about how to pursue their work. And wanting to capture that and share that broadly so it could expand far beyond my individual time and the time of the people who are involved in Converge, put together the book Impact Networks as along with the toolkit and documentary as a way to help open source what we'd learned and share what we'd learned from the people who have been on the ground doing this work for generations, right? Yes. Again, building on lessons from social movements and community organizing and so forth, but also bringing in new lessons and identifying common patterns and frameworks between them. So
David, thank you for that beautiful flyby. So much to dig into. And I know in a minute, Alon's going to want to dig into what exactly are these networks? How are they different? But you said a couple of things that really struck me that I think would be wrong to just kind of gloss over them. One is that part of the way forward is we actually have to talk to people and dialogue with people we don't normally talk to. And I've seen that in business, right? So businesses need to actually talk with environmental organizations, right? NGOs need to talk to business. Government needs to have voices at the table that are beyond government. And we need to take the time to explore our common ground and also to allow for divergent thinking. We know from research that the more divergent a group it is, the more likely it is to come up with innovative solutions to complex problems, right? And so when we work in our silos, we wind up coming up with suboptimal solutions to complex problems. And you gave a couple of great examples. So I wonder, before we talk about networks, do you have any thoughts on just generally how maybe as a society, we need to lean into both dialogue and maybe more cross-sectoral, if you will, interaction?
I think you pointed to something that's really important there. It's only through exploring divergence can we find the places where we overlap. And you know, we have to explore and understand the many different perspectives we have. There's no single person who can hold, or even single organization who can hold all the complexity of these systems on their own. People see and experience these complex issues and complex systems very differently. We all just have one piece of the puzzle, right? There's nobody who can hold it all. And so we have to come together. Yes, we have to create better shared understanding of what's happening and why, but also really acknowledge the places where we disagree. And only from, again, from divergence, that exploration of the many different perspectives, when we have that space, then we can start to see, oh, there are actually, maybe we disagree on 9 out of 10 things, but we do agree on this piece of it, and we can work together on that slice of it. And that can become, you know, a foundation upon which we can begin to strengthen our connection, our increase the flow of information between us, more learning, and opens us up to maybe hearing different perspectives from one another. And then also, maybe over time, we'll create the spaces and the opportunities for us to dig deeper into the places where we disagree, you know, not to convince the other person of our point of view, but really listening to understand and inquire.
David, you've mentioned in your book that humans have always organized in networks, but you also make some distinction. So could you clarify, what do you mean by an impact network as is in your own experience, what works?
You're right. Networks they're all around us. Right? There are biological networks in our brains. There are the mycelial networks underneath the forest floor. There's technological networks, the internet, et cetera. And networks are just webs of relationships connecting people or things. And you know, most everybody's aware of the social networks around us, the in-person social networks through work and life, the online social networks. But what many people don't realize is that networks can actually be deliberately organized to do more than just create social connection. They can be deliberately organized around a specific purpose to increase the flow of information and learning on behalf of that purpose, and or also to facilitate shared collaborative action around that purpose. And we can incorporate structures that actually help us to organize in those ways. The difference from kind of the common or traditional hierarchical structures that we see in organizations everywhere and in institutions is, you know, rather than a single leader or a single group who is at the top of the pyramid making the decisions, passing those decisions down, instead it's flatter. As a network, it's much more decentralized. Decision making and leadership is shared, and that has benefits. It also has some challenges. We can get into some of those. Some of the benefits are being able to engage large numbers of people. People retain their individual autonomy, and we can bring together very different perspectives, as we were just discussing, and create shared understanding and identify new solutions or pathways through these complex issues. They have challenges as well. They don't have the same level of ability to consistently get things done as efficiently as hierarchies, which have a very, very clear organizing structure. And there are some pathways through those challenges that I'm exploring now in my present work. But back to your question, what are your impact networks? They are networks that are deliberately organized to advance learning or collaborative action around a specific purpose. So it's networks with intention.
Mm-hmm. And what would be the key difference, the key step of moving, for instance, from a learning network to an action network or even a movement network?
I see all impact networks start as learning networks or have a learning component embedded within them. You know, we have to learning networks. So maybe we can think of it like this. If social networks are about connection, then learning networks are about connection and learning or the flow of information. And then action networks say we're going a step further to deliberately support and organize collaborative action. So they're about connection, learning, and action. And with each piece, you add a bit more structure, right? A bit more organization, maybe some more governance processes. And then movement networks are really networks of networks. We see this in the shape that a lot of social movements have taken. Some of this builds on the work of Leslie Crutchfield or How Change Happens and others, that so many social movements, if you look at their structure, they have individual chapters or smaller networks that are present in a particular region or a particular aspect of the larger movement. And they're relatively autonomous, taking action, making decisions that make sense for them locally, but then also connected across multiple different chapters as part of this much larger movement that's connected together through a higher level shared purpose and often a set of principles that weaves them together. And that allows these networks of networks to again, be able to take action and make decisions locally that make sense, but also then to activate at a much larger scale, sharing learning information and then taking advantage of those whirlwind moments when we can bring everybody, catalyze everybody to move on something. So they're just different forms of impact networks. No one is necessarily better than the other. They're kind of fit for purpose. And it is important to think about what's the right form, I think, at the right stage for the issue.
David, I feel like a mosquito in a nudist colony. There's lots of stuff I want to kind of jump on here and talk about. But I'm curious, what do you see as you kind of hinted at it, the biggest barrier? So what you're saying makes sense, which is, you know, we often work in these silos. We're not able to tackle the whole problem. We don't see the whole problem. And you've talked about these three different kind of movements, and we'll dig into that a bit. In a more meta way, I guess, what do you see as the biggest obstacle to more of this happening? So might say, if this makes sense, right, that people come together more in networks. And like, I have a good friend who started something she called the Leverage Lab, which she wouldn't call it in your term a network, but it is. It's a group of people in the textile industries, including small and large companies, that came together around how do we solve particular problems around waste or around recycling, et cetera. But what do you see as the biggest, you know, things that get in the way of more of these networks happening or thrive?
Yeah, a number of things. One, we referenced earlier, I think that the way that funding landscape in the social sector is set up, it's vast majority is focused on individual organizations and not really strengthening the connections between them, strengthening the systems as a whole. And as a result, that changes the incentive structures and how individuals think about their own work and proving that causation. I think another barrier is often just individual personality conflicts get in the way, that it's hard to talk about difference, and it's hard to have conversations you don't normally have with people you don't normally have them with. And that these things, these types of networks, they don't just happen spontaneously as we maybe like to think that they would, but really it requires leadership. A different form of leadership maybe than we see in hierarchical environments, but leadership nonetheless to catalyze these efforts, to bring people together for the first time, to help weave the connections between them and help facilitate these types of conversations that actually bring people from across the system together in a new way. And this is one of the barriers, that type of leadership, that network leadership, isn't really taught in schools very much. You know, we It's not shown on the cover of magazines like the heroic leaders are, the individual leaders who we see at the head of companies. This more facilitative leadership, this servant type of leadership, you know, we've seen it come up and again over the years. People are pointing to it, but it's not recognized, I think, or incentivized in the same way, because so often these leaders who are catalyzing and supporting these collective efforts, we rarely ever know who they are, because they're behind the scenes and they're quick mm-hmm. to share the credit, and it's really not about them. It's about the collective, and it's about the effort itself. So those are a few barriers. And then one more, something I'm pursuing now with the work of DAOs, these decentralized autonomous organizations that we're seeing emerge in Web3, is, you know, we don't have great technological infrastructure to support coordination at scale that allows large groups of people to have shared decision making over a trust of money or shared resources, and in a way that still retains the individual autonomy of folks. I think I'm seeing some efforts to make progress on that, and some platforms that are developing, but it's still early days, and right now it's still challenging. It has to sort of be done almost manually with lots of administrative cost and lots of commitment from the individual members. So
there's a lot there. We're going to have to talk about that technology piece as an enabler. Two things you said really struck me. One was, we can't really talk about networks, more effective networks, without talking about ego and the way our desire to be in charge and in control, especially as leaders, gets in the way of our collaborating. And I've seen that in real time. The other piece you raised that's so important is, you know, is the funders need to drive more networks. And at Blueprint, for example, we had one potential donor who said to us, I'm not going to fund you unless you're working with others on this. And it actually drove us to collaborate with the Boys and Girls Club in something we were going to try and do alone. And it's now going to be a much more effective project. But it wouldn't have happened if the funder hadn't literally said to us, no, I'm not interested in funding you if you're working on that alone. So this mm-hmm. first ego and letting go of ego towards what a lot of people call this more eco consciousness or collaboration, but also the funders have to get smarter at pushing for true network. And I like your term, not just collaboration, but network. To me, these impact networks are a lot more focused. It's not just, well, we're going to collaborate, let them know what's going on. No, we're going to work on this together to maximize our resources and capability. And that's a leap that I think is really important. And the funders need to be talking to you too. So think about, how can we push people to do more of this?
And I think it's a real challenge for funders, because it's about supporting or encouraging these types of efforts without controlling them, mm-hmm. without dictating. Yeah, exactly. Without dictating the specific outcomes. I've seen lots of examples where funders say, we want you all to collaborate to accomplish XYZ with these specific outcomes. But really, again, that just removes the autonomy of the individual actors who are actually coming together to work on the thing, to have conversations, to identify what they think needs to happen and what they can do about it. So from a funder's perspective, I think, yes, encouraging, they really do have a unique opportunity to support these types of efforts, because they are often thinking and looking at a systems level, and they've often developed good relationships with various actors across a system or a place. But creating the space for those folks to come together and have conversations, but again, without controlling it, we can have a deliberate process, but then allow for emergent results. We can deliberately bring people together and have these conversations, identify what we can and want to do together. But only then, once you actually let the people who are on the ground doing the work determine what they can and want to do, then we can start to identify specific outcomes that they would want to pursue.
And David, you mentioned that one of the types of impact networks is the movement network. And we wonder, could you give us maybe a couple of examples of what is a movement network? We belong ourselves to the EAN, who wants to foster, to create a movement of elders. But it's not yet movement network. It's a solo network, if you like. So could you say a little more about that? Give some examples.
I think I'll give an example of one that maybe many people wouldn't think of as a movement, but I see it as a movement network, and that is the California Landscape Stewardship Network, because it really does connect multiple networks together on to steward a movement across a much larger region. And so this is the California Landscape Stewardship Network connects together 30 different regional networks, including the Santa Cruz Mountain Stewardship Network, which I referenced earlier. It's one of the 30. And they don't dictate what those regional networks are doing or focused on, but they recognize that there are many different regional networks that are focused on large landscape stewardship across the state of California. But if we connected them together to support shared learning, to identify common issues or common goals at the statewide level, and they've been really successful in that. At some ideas have bubbled up in the local networks, including the Santa Cruz network, one such that then they were able to take to the state level and kind of use the collective power of their voice to make a change. One such example was in the Santa Cruz network, a group of members realized that the permitting processes for important environmental restoration work were pretty similar as building a new condo. They were really timely, it took a long time, really costly. It was a big barrier to just restoring a creek bed, for example, and got in the way of a lot of this important environmental restoration work. And so that they kind of started to talk about that. They moved it up to the statewide network, this California Landscape Stewardship Network, engaged more members, brought it to the Secretary of Agriculture, and now it is a statewide initiative called Cutting Green Tape. So that's an example of maybe we don't see it as a typical social movement that we would often think about, but yet it's a good example of how networks of networks can come together to address bigger issues. Maybe a more kind of obvious example of a movement is the Otpor movement in Serbia, which was integral to the ouster of Slobodan Milosevic in 2000. And like many common social movements, what happened at first was there was this big whirlwind moment where lots of people came to the streets in protest. But a lot of times after we have that whirlwind moment, there's not a structure for people then to plug into. There's not any kind of collective action for them to plug into and to continue to engage. And so that the energy just sort of dissipates. And so there was that example at first, and change didn't happen in the way that they were hoping. Continued his rule. And so then over time, some folks from that initial example started Otpor, which means resistance in Serbian. And what they did was kind of what I described earlier, where they had multiple local chapters where people were able to plug in locally and do smaller actions that made sense for their local town or local region to demonstrate this resistance. But then these chapters were connected together. They were sharing information. They were sharing learnings. They were supporting each other because there wasn't a single head of the movement. It was very difficult for the powers that be to cut off the head or to strangle the movement. They tried to imprison some individuals, but it was a decentralized network, so it didn't kill the movement as a whole. And because these local chapters were connected together at the moment where it made sense to then come out to the streets again in mass protest, they were able to activate it just like that. And eventually it was a driving force behind what actually ended up taking back the power for the people. So that's a more traditional example, maybe, of a social movement.
And what does it require from leadership, particularly when it's so vast and across many regions or many areas, possibly, as you said, many boundaries? You've already mentioned something about leadership. But are there some, not prerequisite, but the qualities that are needed there for this to happen?
I think it's really similar type of leadership that we see maybe at these large national movement network scales, but also at the very local learning network or impact network scales. I see it as the very similar type of leadership, this facilitative leadership, servant leadership, network leadership. It's a type of leadership that doesn't tell people what to do. It's not directive, but instead it supports people to come together and discover what they can and want to do together. It's it's leadership that is not based on kind of rules and regulations, but is the structures and processes that these leaders use are, you know, what I referenced earlier, it's deliberate process to allow for emergent results. It is planful, but it's planning for emergence. There's a few key roles that you see expressed over and over. One is the act of catalyzing, which is bringing people together or starting a new conversation or, you know, seeing an opportunity to bring people together to pursue something and creating that space for it. The second is weaving, which is, you know, deliberately building relationships of introducing and connecting people together, of focusing on the connective tissue between us. Third is facilitation, which is, you know, supporting conversations of creating these spaces for divergence and, you know, the conversations that people don't normally have with people they don't normally have them with. Facilitation is a really important skill for these types of, you know, collective action. And then coordination, which is really a lot of the back of the house things that many people don't see. But what's the underlying infrastructure we're going to use? How are we going to communicate? How are we going to share information? How do we share and distribute resources? And so the back of the house coordination, kind of the day-to-day work that's necessary.
And that's key to moving to action. Yes. Mm-hmm,
exactly.
So David, you hinted earlier, I think it's interesting this to say a bit, not too much maybe for brevity, around the role technology needs to play in in developing this more networked action society.
Yeah, right now we don't have very many legal structures that really fit these types of networks very well. Often they just go with an LLC because it's sort of the minimum viable structure, but still somebody tends to own the LLC and therefore somebody's name is on the bank account. And it's very hard to have a group of any significant size kind of collectively manage an account or collectively manage resources and also have the individual autonomy to be able to, you know, move yourself out of whatever that collective is if you don't like how it's moving forward, or retaining the custody of your own resources that you've put in if you feel like it's going in a wrong direction. And also the technological tools that we have and use today to communicate with one another or to share resources with one another, they almost unanimously go through some centralized entity, that there is a big company like a Google or a Facebook or a PayPal or whatever it is, who we're having to trust this centralized entity to retain our data and to use it properly and to connect us together. And so what this Web3 movement is trying to do is create more decentralized technologies so that we can communicate and share resources from peer to peer without having to go through some centralized entity. And one of the things that it's enabling now is for a group of people of really any size to collectively have a shared wallet or a shared account of resources. And through whatever voting mechanisms you want to set up, being able to determine how those resources are spent, while also allowing individuals to quit the collective and retain the custody of the resources that they put in if they disagree with a major decision. So for me, it's opening up the door to much more decentralized ways of working. That's why they're called DAOs, these decentralized autonomous organizations, decentralized in decision making and in leadership, autonomous in the individual autonomy of its members, and but yet still with organizational structure, right? Not chaotic, really, you know, creating the just enough structure that we need to be able to coordinate at much larger scales.
if we may shift from the collective, which we've talked a lot, to the more personal. As you know, we call this regenerative conversations. And from your perspective, how do you try personally to live a more regenerative life?
This has shifted a lot for me in the past year and a half, because I have a 14-month-old daughter. And so it's, for me, it's, she's been a great teacher in presence, because she is always very attuned to what is happening in that exact moment. She's not thinking about the future and she's not thinking about the past. She's very focused on that exact moment. And so that has been a generative practice for me, being, you know, staying in presence, of noticing when, you know, a piece of my brain, whatever dopamine center, lights up and wants to reach for my phone for that quick hit. But then, you know, she has been a teacher in that way too, because she, you know, she then finds my phone very interesting, and I have to think about what is it in my behavior that is turning this phone, and do I want her to act in the same way? So it's shifting my attention on my own self and my behaviors. And for me, that is regenerative, because it's about practicing better habits, I think, and having greater awareness on, you know, where my habits come from and what's kind of influencing my behaviors, whether consciously or subconsciously. Other than that, I spend a lot of time in nature. I'm here in the Pacific Northwest in Cascadia, because I love the forest and the mountains and the water. It's, you know, I think connecting with nature is really therapeutic. And then I play music as well. And there's some different kind of emotional quality that arises when I'm engaged with music, that I think we can express emotion in, I don't know, much more vibrant ways sometimes than we can just through our physical expressions or through words. So personally, those are a few of the regenerative practices that I have.
Thank you.
I was thinking when you said that about your 14-month-old, and congratulations and condolences. That a couple of times is mostly congratulations. I say that Harry Chapin, the famous folk singer, protest singer, in many ways, he had a line in one of his songs: "If we're going to have a couple of kids, I guess we have to worry about the future times." So also, when we have children, I think we just become aware of the way we are more viscerally connected to the future. I hear so many parents, right, who are thinking about the way forward, say that very thing. Just the other day, some colleague said to me, "I just keep thinking about what kind of a world is, you know, my kid's going to be my age in," and their kids, right? So it kind of, another question we often ask people, David, is, given all the challenges we face in the world and your work, what evidence or things do you see that gives you the most hope that we're going to find a way forward?
Yeah, I'm searching for that hope. I go through peaks and valleys of that hope and despair. I do see hope in younger generations wanting to contribute, of placing an importance on collectivism and on the planet and the environment. And it's been my personal mission in life for many years now to catalyze others to make their greatest contribution, because I've seen so many of my peers and others over the years really caring about many different things, but lots of care. There's a real heart-centered energy there, but also kind of attached to that is a lot of frustration, because things aren't moving, and that they don't know how to plug in, that there aren't very many opportunities to plug in that also allow for, you know, a what seems to be a, you know, positive individual future and security for themselves and so forth. And the Web3 movement is giving me hope. I've been to a number of conferences now over the past couple years where there are people coming together who are really united in shared values around how we coordinate better at larger scales. It's, you know, it's all coordination. We have to work well together as a species to address these big issues, and doing so in a way that, you know, again, people have ownership in the things that they are, and decision-making rights in the things that they're contributing to. So I see, along with the increased focus on networks and different types of organizing structures, I see a paradigm shift happening in the way that we organize. And that is giving me hope. And that's why I'm dedicating my personal attention there.
Yeah, you know, it's Peter Senge, who's one of the people that we follow, you know, and know. And, you know, Peter says the definition of a system problem is one where the outcome produced by the system is not what most of the individuals would choose. And I like kind of what I agree with you. I think what gives us hope is I think people want a different kind of present and future. They're not apathetic about that for the most part. Yeah, there's some people maybe not aligned with that, but that's not the norm now, especially among young people across the world. But the system itself continues to produce outcomes that individuals might not choose. So I think one thing that's so exciting about, you know, the work that you're doing and others are doing around networks is obviously that's one of, not the solution, but one of the ways we have to, you know, Alan knows I like the word hack the system, because the system itself is the problem, you know, and it has to be hacked and changed. And I think impact networks are a great hack. So I applaud the work you're doing. I think they have a lot of potential.
And from that perspective, David, how would you describe the emerging edge of your work? Because you mentioned that you were working since the publication of the book, you've moving on some additional domains. So could you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. One of the things I've noticed in networks is that they're really good at bringing large groups of people together and finding a way through complexity finding our way through difference to identify new pathways forward. But they often struggle in consistently getting things done and doing some of the boring work, kind of the day-to-day work that has to happen. And also, you know, because of their more emergent nature, they often struggle with role clarity and accountabilities and really understanding who is responsible for what, and the individual is understanding here's the specific role I'm playing and the responsibilities that I'm taking on, and attached to that having accountability mechanisms so that the collective is holding the individuals accountable, but also the individuals are holding the collective accountable to compensate them, you know, appropriately for doing that work. A lot of times I see so much unpaid work happen because just those mechanisms aren't set up well, that people are expected to kind of go above and beyond without promises of fair compensation. So, you know, that's all led me to co-found something called HATS Protocol, which is a mechanism for delegating individual roles and responsibilities and their associated authorities and accountabilities or rewards to individuals or teams in these more collective and decentralized environments. It's called HATS because we wear many different hats in an organization. And the short version is it's a way of identifying here are the specific roles or hats that we need worn for this, you know, this larger collective endeavor. And then being able to actually either individuals claiming those hats and saying, I'm going to take on this role for a period of time, or a team doing that, or the collective delegating that power to an individual or team. And when you have this hat in your possession, it's actually a specific kind of token, but that's the underlying tech we don't need to know about. But when you have this hat in your possession, it automatically then unlocks the different permissions and access you need to whatever information or whatever platforms the collective is using. You don't, without knowing any of the passwords, you could be a signer on a shared account. You could be able to post to the organization's Twitter page, have access to certain information channels or folders, whatever it is, and also then facilitate the flow of resources or accountabilities between the individual and the collective as well. And at the same time, see visually all of the different things that are happening. Here are all the different hats in this network or this organization. Here are the ones that are worn, that aren't worn, really clarifying who's doing what and what work isn't being done, and clarifying commitments. A big part of that inspiration behind this too is in networks and a lot of collective movements, we We often resort to consensus decision making, but consensus is really slow and really painful, and often waters down the risk tolerance because we're doing something that feels safe for everybody. But we need to be able to move more quickly, I think, and take risks, even in collective environments. And that means not everybody has to be involved in every decision, but instead we need to be able to delegate and trust that individuals or teams can make decisions in a specific domain, right? A constrained delegation in a way. Mm-hmm. And if they then do something that's not in accordance with the collective, then of course that trust or that delegation can be revoked. But you know, delegation, I think, is going to be a really important piece of how this collective work scales, even beyond the level where we can all know each other and have trust with each other. How can we scale at much, much larger scales where we don't always have those social bonds, but we can still coordinate with one another? So that's
so, David, we'll make some final comments in just a moment. Our time is pretty much up now, but two things. First, just quickly, where can people get a hold of you and find out more?
Yeah, of course. On Twitter, you can find me at Dave Ehrlichman, D-A-V Ehrlichman, E-H-R-L-I-C-H-M-A-N. I'm also on LinkedIn. If you just search my name, the Converge website, converge.net, has linked to the book and the Impact Network's documentary, which is free, as well as the Impact Network's toolkit, which is lots of free open source facilitation guides and surveys and network mapping guides that you can use and adapt to your own work. So I hope you do. Those are the best places.
Fantastic. David, what a great conversation. Thanks for your good work. Bon, you know, as I was listening today and we had this dialogue with David, I was thinking about Paul Hawken, who, you know, we know, who wrote a book called Blessed Unrest. And he kind of really talked about how all over the world, really for the first time in human history, we have, you know, this a movement without a leader, which are groups and people organically and systemically coming together to solve problems locally, regionally, sometimes globally. And yet, even when I read Paul's book, what occurred to me is the weakness in not having a leader. David pointed out to us today, which I think is true, that leaderless movements are more robust. Look at the Arab Spring or things like that, where you can't take out the movement because it has no leader, right? But the downside of that is that you may not have the focus and organization and systemic effort that is required to create change. So just my head is popping from all kinds of things today from our conversation with David, and putting that together in my mind that this blessed unrest is a thing of great hope. And there's all this energy and action, and yet we need to find ways for greater collaboration and for more focus in that action. And I think the kind of work that David is doing is a good example of that. Any final thoughts from you, Alon? Go ahead, David, I'll give you a moment.
Just one quick on that. I hope we can create not leaderless movements, but leaderful movements. Yes, anybody can step up into leadership.
Anyone can be a leader. Yeah, amen. Thank you. Alon?
Thank you very much, David. This was most enriching. And I recommend strongly reading your book. There are many things that you didn't have time to talk about today that are there. And as you said, this is a service you're making to make that available, to make that available to many people that you don't necessarily can deal directly with. So we wish you the best in continuing your work, your leading edge work. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. And I want to say on behalf of Lon and I, thank you for listening. Please, if you like this, let us know. If you don't like it, let us know. We'd love your feedback. Please pass it on to others. And we'd love your ideas on topics around the way forward and guests that you think it would be great for us to have. I also thank our great producer, Jim Burke. So until next time, thank you for joining us on the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.
I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to our podcast. You have many choices, and we appreciate your interest and support. You can reach us at our email address, thewayforwardrc@gmail.com. I would also like to thank our sponsor, Elders Action Network. Their website is eldersaction.org. Until next time, I'm Jim Burke, and this was the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast on Podbeam.